Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic, true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 2, Rivers of Cash. Our new King Richard arrived in London at the beginning of September 1189, one of the few times he ever set foot in the city. A mere 2 months had passed since his father, Henry Plantagenet, had been laid on his bier. But Richard had already been busy, granting castles and lands to supporters, freeing political prisoners from the kingdom's jails, even rewarding his father's man, the great knight William Marshall, with a Welsh lordship and an Irish heiress bride, a combination which would make Marshall one of the richest men in England. Lionheart negotiated the kind of compromise with Philip Augustus that had rarely been conceivable to his father, sorting out mutually agreeable boundaries to disputed territories, settling debts, and even agreeing that his overly delayed wedding to Princess Elise would take place at last. Historian Frank McLinn says of those days, Richard was doing a number of things simultaneously, displaying his magnanimity, showing kingly wisdom, and contrasting his own generosity, reliability, and decisiveness with the dithering, prevaricating, and manipulative Henry. There was political theater, such as trotting one of Henry Plantagenet's more unpopular ministers through London streets draped in chains, a signal to one and all that the old days of rich men buying favor were over. Richard's beloved mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, now the Dowager Queen, entirely at liberty for the first time in 15 years, was restored to glory. Lionheart sent orders to England that she could do whatever she wished in the kingdom. His mother would enjoy no ordinary regency. This was like the power of a king. She began to sign documents, Eleanor, by the grace of God, Queen of England, a title she would relish for the rest of her life. The lady would again take on all the activity she craved, traveling across England at a breakneck pace, perhaps learned from life with Henry, settling quarrels, ending evil policies, demanding that oaths of fealty be made to her adored son. She particularly seems to have enjoyed releasing dissidents from her dead husband's prisons. The chronicler Roger of Hoveden said that she told them she entirely understood the remarkable happiness that accompanied newfound freedom. But as proof that no good deed can go unpunished, Roger's fellow chronicler, William of Newburgh, groused that this generosity merely dumped England's criminals back into society. Mother and son arranged for him to be crowned with immense ceremony at Westminster, a swirling four-day extravaganza of everything we most love about medieval life. Nobles in jewels and furs, bishops in cranberry robes, Eleanor herself royally outfitted at considerable government expense, choirs, knights shouting Vivat Rex as they beat their shields, sacred oils to anoint the monarch's stripped body, public acclamations, incense, trumpets, drums and flutes, altars, oaths to protect and defend, a golden crown said to be so heavy that two earls stood by to support its weight, golden spurs, crowds surging through streets alight with bonfires, trestle tables loaded with food, the hilarity that arises so naturally from quite a lot of public drunkenness. It was so brilliantly done that it served as the template for the coronations of English kings for centuries. Everyone, except for uninvited women and Jews, had a wonderful time, after which Richard set his mind to his key ambition, going on crusade, a commitment he had made 2 years ago, the first nobleman north of the Alps to take the cross. Running the largely peaceful kingdom his father had made was of little interest to Richard, not a man enamored of council meetings and quill pens scratching murky lines of ink across sheets of parchment. This would be the third crusade in a century. Like its predecessors, it would involve popes, kings, knights, princesses, courage, endurance, clever luck, impossible disaster, and now mythic heroes who once upon a time, some 800 years ago, were real people. 40 years had gone by since the Second Crusade of Louis, Eleanor, Conrad, Edessa, Mount Cadmos, and Dorylaeum had turned to fog and shadow outside the walls of Damascus. Muscled young men who had survived it were now familiar with the pains and regrets of old age. Eleanor, in her 20s when she left Antioch, was in her late 60s. Henry Plantagenet, a teenager living in Anjou during the fighting on Mount Cadmos, was dead by now, as were Louis Capet and Conrad of Germany, the leaders of armies that had marched across half the known world. Bernard of Clairvaux, the fantastic voice which had summoned tens of thousands to fight for God, had been dead for decades. Prince Raymond of Antioch, Pope Eugenius, and Suger, all were gone. Richard Lionheart and Philip Augustus, the kings who would carry the weight of this crusade, hadn't been born when the prior crusade survivors limped home. One of the few who truly understood what was about to happen was Frederick Barbarossa, the aged Holy Roman Emperor who'd been at the failed battle for Damascus as a teenager. Aside from Barbarossa, virtually the only man standing who had been alive 40 years before and would lead an army in battle again, this time, was a Muslim. We know him as Saladin, very likely the only historic Arab most of us have ever heard of. He would become so famous that, decades later, fascinated writers would place Eleanor of Aquitaine in his bed during the Second Crusade. Those stories were pure invention. She had been a grown woman, Saladin a boy, with no reason even to remark each other's face during the Second Crusade. But the stories that would be written about her son Richard Lionheart and Saladin this time around would be true. We need to ratchet the calendar back to the days when the suffering leper king Baldwin of Jerusalem was still alive, during the reign of Henry Plantagenet. Baldwin had a sister, Sibylla. Like all too many noble ladies, the princess had matrimonial problems. She was a widow, mother to a little boy, and she and her son were the most direct heirs to her sickly brother's throne. In that place, at that time, she badly needed to marry again, and her affections had settled on an immigrant nobleman named Guy of Lusignan. The man who'd masterminded the Lusignan attack on Eleanor's caravan years before, when the teenaged William Marshall was wounded and captured. Guy's notorious family had turned to the Latin States some years before for a new world to conquer. That effort had proved a remarkable success. Guy's father had risen to the top of Jerusalem's ruling class, charming his way into some very well-connected beds. Then, too, despite generations of flickering animosities between the Lusignans and their overlords, the Dukes of Aquitaine, that title now in the possession of the Plantagenets, the Lusignan status as Plantagenet vassals lent credibility to the idea that they might be able to tap into their liege lord's considerable glory. The Lusignans, father and son, were accordingly accepted, if grudgingly, into Jerusalem's upper ranks. And if the father had done well, the son did even better. Guy ultimately rocketed past every other contender to wed widowed Princess Sibylla. Married into one of the most powerful families in the Latin East, the new prince was eager to make his mark. Unfortunately for Guy and the kingdom, success did not attend his efforts. He showed scant aptitude for a career as a general, one of the key occupations of kings. His choice of friends also raised eyebrows, since one of them was Reynald of Chantillon, a bellicose Frenchman who'd arrived with the Second Crusade and stayed on to become local royalty through an advantageous marriage of his own. Reynald, a highly offensive thorn in the side of any number of angry Muslims, was an utter embarrassment to Baldwin, a prince who tried to maintain calm in his tumultuous part of the world. Guy's thick-skulled missteps, including his fondness for Reynald, alienated his royal brother-in-law on multiple fronts, ultimately provoking Baldwin into actively working to have Sibylla's marriage annulled. The king's annoyance with his sister's grating husband was so keen that when he couldn't get the annulment, Baldwin altered the succession to skip Sibylla and her consort entirely, placing the future of the dominant kingdom of the Latin States in the hands of Sibylla's little son. A 5-year-old boy was the successor to a king with an exceptionally tenuous life expectancy. Naturally, Baldwin was carried to his grave soon after. Then, the unpredictably predictable happened. The little boy died. While political crises preoccupied Jerusalem's royal family, the city's streets were a teeming cross-cultural bazaar. Time, proximity, and hard-won friendship had opened a great many avenues between Westerners and Saracens. European immigrants, face to face with temperatures, vistas, rainfall, customs, food, and languages unlike anything they had known back home, learned to wear the local clothes, play the local musical instruments, dine pleasurably with exotic spices. There were hawking parties. Scholars and diplomats met, talked, dined with congenial contacts on the other side. Civilians moved across borders. Christian settlers married Muslim locals. Noble European families were delighted by cousins and younger brothers who added Latin states titles and magnificent properties to dynastic inventories. Europeans arriving in this foreign world in the 1170s were astonished at the web of relationships that existed between the old enemies, who by now coexisted very comfortably.
They sat cross-legged on patterned carpets and feathered divans, decorated their stone villas with silk and damask, adorned their ladies with cosmetics and perfumed their rooms with incense, bathed in deep tubs, became conversant in Arabic, cultivated exotic flowers, spiced their rice with saffron and their tea with sugar and lemon, finished off their meals with melons and dates, and entertained themselves with Arabic lutes, and native dancing girls.
It must have been a spectacular carnival. According to the local Bishop of Acre, the sinfully lurid was a daily preoccupation, given his startling assessment that almost every night people are openly or secretly murdered. Men strangle their wives if they dislike them, and wives kill their husbands. In their quieter moments, curious Europeans kept an eye out for marvels they'd only read about back home, like the two-headed snakes, centaurs, and talking parrots that were said to frequent this part of the world. Quite a difference from dull days and nights in boring old Europe. All of this exotic pleasure survived thanks to a series of truces between the King of Jerusalem and the Muslims, contrivances that allowed the vastly outnumbered Europeans to cling to their perch in the Middle East. A 90-year-old Saracen noble named Usama ibn Munqid had spent much of his life observing the Franks, the local term for the wide assortment of European immigrants living in the Outremer after the Second Crusade. While Usama was dismissive of what he called their barbarism, he also gave them credit for their courage, their judicial system, and some of their medicines. He said outright that there were thoughtful, generous, and intelligent Christians in the world, men who had indeed become his friends. These two sides of the world were unquestionably enemies, but at an individual level, there was often respect, tolerance, and even affection. It was a world about to be invaded for the third time in a century by armies from Europe. We know that crusades cost money. This crusade, which had been under consideration back when Henry Plantagenet was alive, had already seen taxes raised 10% on Henry's watch, the famous Saladin tithe. That tax, applied to every type of revenue and everything you owned, was so painful that people were willing to go on crusade to avoid paying it, especially the wealthy, which would help to account for their abnormal mortality rate on the plains of Syria. Even so, it wasn't enough. Throughout the entirety of Richard's monarchy, one is struck by his obsession with money. Rivers of it would be pumped through every pinpoint of his reign. Even tax-loving Henry couldn't match Lionheart's enterprising search for money. Enterprising because Richard couldn't realistically raise taxes one more farthing. He'd inherited a well-stocked treasury, but the compelling necessities of preparing to crusade, paying for a lavish coronation, and buying a fragile peace with his jealous younger brother John motivated Richard to wring all the cash he could from everyone he could. Men unwilling to face the rigors of a crusade, even when prodded by the Saladin tithe, could buy exemptions. Towns paid for new charters. Officials from his father's era who were interested in keeping their old jobs paid for reappointment. Almost every sheriff in the kingdom had to buy his way back in, something most were more than happy to do. They were the country's tax collectors, beneficiaries of a system where the amount due to the royal treasury was set, while the amount they might raise was entirely dependent on their talent at extortion. Losing such a pleasantly lucrative way to earn a living was something most incumbents wished to avoid. The wheels of the immense Plantagenet revenue machine ground very finely indeed. Some former ranking government officials of the Henry era had to buy their way out of trouble with Henry's son, the new king. William the Lion of Scotland, captured during the tag end of the Great Rebellion, got off relatively lightly. The Scots only had to pay 10,000 to gain their king's release from his sacred vow to pay homage to England. The Archbishopric of York, one of the primary positions in the English Catholic Church, went under the hammer, sold to Richard's bastard half-brother Geoffrey. A mere 3,000 gold pieces closed that deal. Geoffrey, so loyal to their father, had recently resigned as Bishop of Lincoln and had no apparent interest in York. But he was strong-armed into the job by Richard, who thus neatly stymied any ambitions his bastard half-brother might have toward the throne. Even so, when Richard left on crusade, he had Geoffrey sign a pledge to stay out of the country, where he was newly a chief churchman, for 3 years. Then take the nobleman Ranulf de Glanville. He had been chief justiciar under Henry Plantagenet, so highly ranked in Henry's esteem that he was chosen to accept the surrender of the Scottish king during the Great Rebellion. Unfortunately for de Glanville, Henry had also picked him to play Eleanor's keeper when she was confined at Winchester. This unavoidable affront to the Dowager Queen was enough for Richard, who slammed de Glanville into a jail cell, even though by this time the former chief of the Plantagenet legal system was almost 80 years old. Ranulf and his family had to come up with 15,000 gold pieces to get himself free. We do have to take a moment for de Glanville, an example of the remarkable stamina demonstrated by people of the 12th century who managed to outlive the dangers of childhood. After being imprisoned in his late 70s and raising a fortune in ransom money, de Glanville joined the Third Crusade, led by none other than Richard. He was at least 77 when he marched out of England. Sadly, he would never march back, dying during the Siege of Acre. The new king began to sell everything he could get his hands on, which in his case was an almost limitless array: titles, knighthoods, forests, right to taxes and tolls, castles, farms, the right to start a market, the right to get out of prison, hawking privileges on royal lands, the right to marry above your station, the right not to marry at all. He made a rare joke after selling the earldom of Northumberland to the elderly Bishop of Durham that he had made a new earl out of an old bishop. He'd even put his legendary sword Excalibur under the hammer, since one chronicle says he offered to trade it to the Sicilians for a fleet of 20 ships. At one point, he bluntly told one of his counselors that he'd sell London if someone would pay him for it. What his citizens made of it is debatable. Historian John Gillingham points out that people were buying something they wanted at prices they were prepared to pay. It took the better part of a year for Richard to feel ready to leave his rather poorer citizenry behind. And it wasn't just money that delayed him. While his inherited empire could scarcely be considered fragile, he was a new king with little experience among his English or Norman subjects. He had no heir. Even Henry, with his 4 living sons, had hesitated to leave for a crusade, a journey of unknown duration and unknown outcome. And Henry's barons had strenuously advised him against it. In addition to the normal assortment of kingly worries, poor harvests, upstart nobles, competitive monarchs, unpredictable tax collections, there was the prospect of combative rivalry among those sons, not exactly an unimaginable concern among the Plantagenets. Richard, with no sons, had to come up with a solution to the ongoing dilemma of his only remaining brother, John. Henry Plantagenet's beloved youngest, repeatedly dangled in Richard's face as Daddy's favorite, was at best sullenly envious of his older brother, at worst a dangerous focal point for the long list of men who already knew they didn't like Richard. Richard spent a lot of money, amounting to outright bribery, to try to soothe John. His brother was draped in honors and titles, married at last to the wealthy Gloucester heiress he'd been betrothed to for years, and handed concessions of land and tax revenues amounting to the entirety of 6 wealthy counties, a third of the country, in exchange for John's oath to stay on the continent and away from England for 3 years. Richard was careful to avoid giving John any real power. The prince had custody of not one significant castle. But Richard had unwisely given his brother a base inside England, one that could and would be exploited while Richard was 2,000 miles away. Richard also had to grapple with how his government would run in his absence. He turned to several trusted servants to act in his stead in England. One was tough old William de Mandeville, friend to Richard's father, a former crusader who had the honor of carrying Lionheart's crown in the coronation procession. The second was the Bishop of Durham, the object of Richard's witticism about new earls and old bishops. The highest-ranking official in the group was yet another William, one William de Longchamp, Richard's trusted longtime manager in the Aquitaine. Of all those ruling in Richard's stead during the Crusade, de Longchamp would become the most notorious. He came from an old Norman family, his people mere commoners, but very loyal to Henry Plantagenet and his boys. Several decades of such diligent fidelity had made the Longchamps nicely well-to-do. Like many rising names in the era of Richard Lionheart, William de Longchamp unabashedly used family funds to buy his way into the bishopric of Ely and shared the position of chief justiciar, to which honors he soon added the robes of the office of the Chancellor of England. Soon thereafter, the price of having legal documents duly sealed in the Chancery office shot up. De Longchamp and his fellow ministers had a great many concerns. The very new king, who had no heir, would be gone on a journey of great peril, people uncomfortably recalling that a bat had flown near the throne during his coronation. Many held the gloomy belief that he would never come back, that their unhappy future would be one of battles between rival nobles, if not actual invasion by the French. There was one man in particular who chose not to go on crusade. His name was John. His nickname was Lackland. He was an enviously unhappy younger brother, and he was supposed to stay away from England for 3 whole years. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again September 30th for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.